For argument, United States versus Johnson. Mr. Potts.
May it please the court. My name is Brian Potts, and I represent the defendant appellant Willie Earl Johnson in this case. This is a conspiracy case gone awry and is a perfect example of why this court has been on a long-term trend to carefully examine and ultimately limit the confines of conspiracy law in this circuit. If this court were to uphold Johnson's conspiracy conviction in this case, it would reverse that trend. Very briefly, the facts. Willie Earl Johnson bought drugs from the wrong people, Craig Vinson and Samba Parker, then leaders of a...
Would it affect his sentence if the conspiracy count were thrown out?
Absolutely.
Because there's also possession, right?
That's correct. But the jury's verdict as to the quantity involved, the 5 grams to 50 grams, was only tied to the conspiracy count. And so under the law in this
circuit...
What
do you mean by tied to the conspiracy count?
If you look at the verdict form and the jury instructions, they were instructed and asked whether or not the conspiracy involved 5 to 50 grams of crack cocaine, and that was their finding. And under the law in this circuit... To have that minimum sentence imposed based on the 5 to 50 grams, the jury must actually make a finding as to what count was involved. And
but is there any doubt that he handled more than 5 grams? I mean, I always have your argument about whether it's all marijuana and so on, but supposing that basketballs and the like refer to cocaine, is there any doubt that he sold at least 5 grams?
You mean with regards to possession?
Yeah.
With intent to distribute? I would say there is a doubt. The government has only pointed to one set of facts that established possession with intent, and that is the July 2nd, 2004 set of phone calls, which involved at most 5 packs, which the government has admitted, and Parker's testimony has been that could be anywhere from roughly 0.9 to 1 grams in a pack. So at most, we're talking about 5 grams for possession with intent. But again, the jury didn't make a finding with regards to the possession with intent count. They only made a finding with regards to conspiracy. And therefore, if you vacate the conspiracy conviction, you must also vacate the minimum sentence finding. And this case really is about conspiracy, and there are 2 conspiracy-related errors that occurred at the trial court that I would like to focus on. Number one, like Garza, Johnson was at most in a buy-sell relationship with Vinson and Parker, and under this court's Cologne decision and others, that is not a conspiracy. Number two, the government alleged in its indictment that Johnson and Garza were members of one single conspiracy, but they failed to prove that at trial, as evidenced by the fact that Garza's sentence has been vacated on the conspiracy count. This was a fatal variance that prejudiced Mr. Johnson, and under this court's Townsend decision, violated his due process rights. Turning to the first point, this court has long held that a buyer-seller relationship is not a conspiracy. I believe that goes back to at least 1963 in this circuit. But over the last 20 years or so, the court has focused on what actually constitutes a buyer-seller relationship, and has found over the years individually that quantity, a large quantity between the buyer and seller alone is not enough to establish a conspiracy. The prolonged nature of the relationship between the buyer and seller alone is not enough to establish a conspiracy. The seller knowing the buyer will resell the drugs is, again, not enough to establish a conspiracy. And what this court's Cologne and Kincannon decisions recently found was, even if you have all of those things, standardized dealings using code, prolonged nature of the relationship, a large quantity of drugs, and the seller knowing the buyer is going to resell the drugs, that's not a conspiracy. You need something else. You need a joint objective. And that's what the government missed at trial in this case. They provided no evidence that there was a joint objective above and beyond a buy-sell relationship. So what do you need for a joint objective? I think it's prudent to ask yourself, did Vincent and Parker have any interest in Johnson's sales to other people? And the answer is no. And similarly, did Johnson have any interest in Vincent or Parker's sales to other people? And again, the answer is no. There was no joint objective. This Cologne the Cologne decision in this court talked about what gave examples of what would constitute a joint objective that would be enough to establish that there was a conspiracy. And that decision said gave what is probably the most common example of a joint objective, and that is sales on credit. And in this case, we have no sales on credit. Parker testified that he never sold any drugs to Johnson on credit. And when you have credit, it makes sense. There is a joint objective. The seller sells to the buyer on credit. They both then have the same objective, and that's the buyer's resale of those drugs. Another example the Cologne decision gave is if the buyer and seller come to an agreement that the buyer is going to go out and look for customers for the seller, then you would have a conspiracy. And if the buyer got a commission on the sales to those customers, there was an agreement and a joint objective to do something other than the buy-sell transaction itself. A perfect example of what actually is a conspiracy in this case is the relationship between Vincent and Parker. Vincent fronted thousands of dollars worth of drugs to Parker, gave him cars to drive around in and sell those drugs, gave him a cell phone to use to sell those drugs. We have none of that here, and Johnson was dealing with the same two people. Johnson was not ever fronted drugs, was given no cars, had no cell phone. There's just not any joint objective other than a buy-sell relationship. Now, the government tries to distinguish the Cologne case and others by pointing to three facts which it says would constitute a joint objective, and that's Vincent's mere offer to Johnson to loan him $30, essentially, even though Johnson didn't accept that. The government says that that's enough to overcome the Cologne decision. And our position is that that is not enough. First of all, $30 is not nearly enough amount of money for there to be a joint objective or a business relationship between the two. And Johnson never agreed to that $30, to owe Vincent $30. The second thing they point to is Johnson's haggling with Vincent over the price these drugs in the same set of phone calls, and Vincent's agreement to give him a $30 discount. Johnson said in the course of arguing with Vincent, trying to get him to give him the discount, he said, "I'm going to buy a lot of drugs from you. I've got a friend that's going to buy drugs from you also." The government has tried to point to the Cologne decision to argue that is the same as the situation that was discussed in Cologne, but that's not the case. In Cologne, you had what the court was saying was if the buyer and seller had an agreement, had standardized terms where the buyer went out and found purchasers for the seller, brought them back, got a commission on the sales to those new purchasers, that would be evidence of a conspiracy. But here we don't have any of that. We just have Johnson haggling over the price of drugs from his seller. The second point I would like to discuss is the fact that there was a fatal variance that prejudiced Mr.
Johnson. I thought
you
said that the government had three arguments.
Oh, I'm sorry. The third argument was the warning of police presence in the area. Johnson, in a conversation with Vincent after he had ordered some drugs and Vincent was on the way to meet him, Johnson said, "Hey, I saw police in the area," and therefore the government argues that somehow is a joint objective to evade the police. But in fact, they each have individual objectives of not getting caught. That's why Johnson is warning him of police being in the area, just because he's involved in that transaction, that illicit transaction.
Well, that's not the only interpretation of that piece of evidence. The government spins it a little bit differently, as it is entitled to do. There's also that strange trip to Iowa. The government hasn't relied on that in its briefing here, but it was part of the evidence at trial. I'm not sure I quite understand it, but the three of them apparently did travel to Iowa together to do some sort of a low-level drug deal with members of Vincent's family? Is that,
You described it well when you said the word strange, because that's exactly what it was. I mean, this is the epitome of the unreliable evidence that Parker introduced at trial. I mean, basically the facts introduced are that Johnson, Parker, and Vincent traveled all the way from Aurora, Illinois, to somewhere in Iowa, where Parker, I don't think, knew exactly where in Iowa. He couldn't remember where they went in Iowa. And then Parker testified that Johnson sold anywhere from one to three $10 packs of crack cocaine to Vincent's own family members in Iowa,
and that's,
make any sense.
That's all they took with them?
The only testimony from Parker is that Johnson sold one to three $10 packs of crack cocaine.
Was there any testimony about some other purpose of the visit that can't possibly have been the only purpose of the visit?
Not that I can recollect. Parker, I think, also testified that he had marijuana with him and that he might have been selling marijuana. But, again, you've got Vincent, who's selling thousands of dollars worth of crack cocaine, and Parker, who's selling thousands of dollars worth of crack cocaine, traveling all the way to Iowa with Johnson to sell $30 worth of crack cocaine to Vincent's family. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
There had to be something else going on, but there's nothing in the record that offers any other explanation for the trip?
No. And there's Hartline also testified that Johnson was there, but didn't testify as to any illicit activities going on with Johnson. The second thing I'd like to focus on is the fatal variance. You have an unusual situation here where a defendant was tried with another defendant as a co-conspirator, as members of a single conspiracy, and that other co-defendant, Garza in this case, is not guilty of conspiracy, and his charge has been vacated based on this court's Cologne and Kincannon decisions. A variance occurs when the government alleges something in its indictment and it fails to prove that at trial. That's exactly what happened here. They alleged that Garza and Johnson were members of the same conspiracy, and they failed to prove it at trial. That was a fatal variance, but that's not enough alone. You also have to show that Johnson was prejudiced. And if you read through the trial transcript, it's obvious that the government's focus in this case was Garza. The joint, all the pretrial motions focus on Garza. Even the closing argument starts with Garza and then goes to Johnson. A huge amount of evidence was introduced against Garza compared to a very small amount of evidence introduced against Johnson. This is the quintessential prejudicial case. He shouldn't have been tried with Garza in the first place, and they certainly were not members of a single conspiracy.
When the post-verdict stipulation was entered dismissing the conspiracy conviction against Garza, was there an admission that the government couldn't prove the conspiracy as against Garza, or that the government couldn't prove that Garza had joined the conspiracy?
There was a stipulation filed by the government that essentially said that they didn't have sufficient evidence in the record to uphold. They didn't think this court would believe that there was sufficient evidence in the record as to Garza's conspiracy count because of the Cologne decision, because all they'd introduced was quantity, prolonged nature of the relationship, and the fact that Garza was reselling the drugs. And the Cologne decision said that's not enough. And so they explicitly in that stipulation cited the Cologne, and I have a copy I could provide if you'd like. They cited the Cologne and Kincannon decisions explicitly for that proposition.
Well, are we to take that as an admission by the government that they can't prove a conspiracy at all, or just that they couldn't prove it as?
If the government thought it wasn't worth this court's time to hear that case and agreed to let him out of jail, you could take that for what it's worth, I guess. But they've agreed to vacate the conspiracy count based on the Cologne and Kincannon decision.
The case was stronger in your view against Garza?
I would say much stronger. I mean, Garza, there were 7 to 8 times as many phone contacts with Vincent and Parker from Garza. Garza was buying heroin, not crack cocaine, was buying it in larger quantities. There was more of a prolonged relationship between Garza and Vincent and Parker than Johnson. There was a lot more money involved than Johnson. I mean, Johnson, you're talking about at most a few $100 worth of purchases. And, you know, now he's serving 6 years in prison over a few $100 worth of purchases. I see my white light is on. I'd like to touch on one other thing. Again, and we've talked about it. If you vacate the conspiracy count, we believe you also have to vacate the minimum sentence and the telephone count, because the conspiracy is an underlying element of the telephone count. So if they didn't have sufficient evidence to prove conspiracy, or the conspiracy was prejudiced, then you also have to vacate the telephone count.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Potts. Mr. Getter?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Matthew Getter on behalf of the United States. The main issue here is whether there was sufficient evidence for the jury reasonably to have concluded that Mr. Johnson was involved in a conspiracy with Mr. Vinson, Mr. Parker, and several others. The government believes that the answer to that question is yes. To address first Judge Sykes' question about the differences between Mr. Garza and Mr. Johnson and why the government agreed to vacate count one with respect to Mr. Garza and not Mr. Johnson. There were a number of differences in terms of the evidence between Garza and Johnson. And it doesn't focus on the quantities of drugs with which they were dealing with Vinson and Parker. It focuses on
what is your best evidence of conspiracy that Johnson was part of a conspiracy with Vinson?
There are a number of factors, Your Honor.
Well, what's your best?
Our best are the exhibit.
One. What is your best?
The best one is the conversation in which Mr. Johnson told Mr. Vinson that that he wanted the five for the price of four because I'm bringing someone else who also wants to buy drugs from you, which shows the interlocking financial relationship between Mr. Johnson and Mr. Vinson and goes to the question of whether there was a joint objective beyond just an agreement to buy.
Wouldn't it be typical for a buyer to say, you know, I'd like a discount because, look, I'm sending other people your way?
It's not. I can't say that that would never happen in any other context besides a conspiracy.
I think it's probably extremely common.
Yeah,
if you say to someone, you know, I'm a really excellent customer of yours, I've referred other people to you.
But when you consider it in conjunction with the other factors in the relationship that
well, I don't
had.
See any other factors except that Johnson buys drugs from Vinson for resale.
There is the fact that Mr. Vinson was willing to agree to sell him five for four, which while it's
well,
only
I don't
one
understand. Look, there's nothing more common than for sellers to offer discounts to buyers.
No, initially Mr. Vinson said you would owe me the money. That's a form of fronting, Your Honor. When Mr. Johnson said, give me five for the price
yeah,
of four.
Yeah, but if he says he doesn't want it, but Johnson is saying, look, I want a discount. I don't want to have a relationship with you. I don't want to be your debtor. I just want a discount.
And Mr. Vinson initially says, are you high? No. I'll give you, you'll owe me the $30 for the fifth pack. And it was at that point.
Well, did Johnson agree?
It's.
How can you have a conspiracy without an agreement?
The end of the conversation, Your Honor, I believe, was Mr. Vinson saying, all right. Johnson had asked.
Yeah, but all right to what? All right to a discount.
Okay, all right to a front. It's a partial front. Whether
I don't understand the partial front. I don't understand that. Partial front means that Johnson has to give money back to Vinson. That's not a discount is not a front. Did Johnson agree to give money back to Vinson?
There was no explicit agreement on Johnson's part to pay the money.
Well, how about
Johnson,
an implicit agreement?
Because Vinson
was
said,
there an implicit agreement
yes.
by Johnson?
Yes.
To pay money back?
Excuse me?
To pay money back to Vinson?
Initially, yes, because
well, what do you mean
Vinson
initially?
Says,
did Johnson agree to pay Vinson money? To repay Vinson in advance?
There is no explicit statement.
Well, what's
by
the
Johnson?
Implicit? What's the implicit? Did Johnson implicitly agree?
I believe so.
Where? Right. What's the evidence that he implicitly agreed to anything? Agreed to give money to Vince.
In that conversation, Your Honor, on July 2nd, it's conversation, it's target phone one, call 5393. In the previous call, Johnson had asked for five for the price of four. And Vinson had said, are you high? And then said, I'll call you back. So now on call 5393, Vinson says, yeah, I'll give it to you, but you got to owe the 30. Johnson said, owe 30? Vinson says, yeah, five of them is 150. He says, damn, can I get no play? And he goes, oh, you want a whole free one? He says, man, I'm going to be bringing you someone else. So
where's the agreement to pay Vinson anything? He's saying, I want the discount because I'm going to refer other customers to you. There's no implicit agreement that he's going to pay the money back to Vinson.
Had Vinson not said, I will give you the fifth one for free, then you have to assume that Johnson would have agreed to get the fifth one for the price.
This is far too tortured for me to understand what you're saying. This is proof beyond a reasonable doubt of a conspiracy?
There are a number of factors, Your Honor.
There aren't any other factors. You keep repeating a standardized. All right, what is another factor?
The mutual trust between the two. In a conversation where Johnson has with Vinson, in a couple of conversations, he says, my girl's little brother wants to do business with you as well. So he's identifying who one of his customers is. So there's a mutual trust in terms of Johnson feeling free to tell Vinson who his customer is.
I don't think the girl's little brother thing, I don't think that was a referral. I think that Johnson was telling Vinson that it was giving him a reason why he needed more drugs to resell, because he had this additional customer. This is Johnson's customer, not Vinson's customer.
Well, Your Honor, if you may recall, at the end of the conversation, it was about 12:30 or so in the morning on July 3rd, after the drugs were delivered and Johnson said to Vinson those drugs were fat, he said to Vinson, we'll get back to you tomorrow. We'll get back up with you tomorrow. Let me get the exact language. Actually, it was presumably the girl's little brother, unidentified male, who said, tell him we'll get at him tomorrow. Johnson then repeats, hey, we're going to get back at you tomorrow. Vinson says, all right. So I don't think you can say that it's just Johnson who's bringing.
Johnson is saying, I need the drugs tomorrow. I have this customer. I have my girl's little brother. Johnson is a dealer. He has his own customers. This is one of his, the little brother is one of his customers.
Yes.
If you say to your supplier, look, I need the drugs. I'm a middleman. I need the drugs because I have a customer. That doesn't have anything to do with conspiracy. That's exactly what you'd say to someone you were buying stuff from. You give it, I need this stuff. Why do I need it? I need it because I have a customer.
But he identifies who the customer
what
is.
What difference does it
because
make?
Because it shows the mutual level of trust that he identifies.
Mutual level of this is just talk, mutual level of trust. All he's saying is, I need the drugs because I have a customer. I have a customer for the drugs.
And he identifies who he is.
What difference does it make?
What do you think, Mr. that Benson's going to steal that? Is that what you mean by the trust, that the customer is going to be stolen by Vinson?
Possibly.
That's not in your brief.
No, it's not. But Judge Flom asked me if that's something that could happen. Possibly.
Well, what else could it be? I mean, disclosing your customer, let's say you do have a buyer sell, if you don't, I'm not asking you to acknowledge it in this case, and you identify, you know, your three most recent customers, just the identification, disclosing the name, why is that, shows you trust that Vinson won't call them directly? I mean, I don't understand.
Not only that, but that you also are protected, you don't feel the need to protect the identity of the person to whom you're selling the drugs.
The very fact you're talking on the phone is a degree of trust, I suppose, right? That Vinson isn't going to call the G.
Well, to a certain degree, of course, Judge.
And why doesn't that do the trick then?
Well, I mean, that's taking it to the illogical extreme.
No, it's your
otherwise
extreme.
Otherwise, you'd never have a conspiracy if you would say that just the fact that you're calling someone means there's.
Well, that's your. But Judge Flom is correct. You obviously trust when you're making a drug deal on the phone. You're trusting that you're talking to a drug dealer and not to the police.
I think there is a difference between merely talking to someone on the telephone and telling that person who your customer is.
Boy, that is such a fine distinction. Boy, are you guys pushing.
The government's position, Your Honor, is that the relationship has to be considered as a whole.
No, it's just words. All you're saying, you turn every buyer-seller relationship into a conspiracy. You know what Justice Jackson said? Conspiracy is the prosecutor's darling. you much prefer conspiracy to a simple possession count.
The possession count here is entirely based on inferences itself, isn't it?
On inferences?
I mean, there isn't any testimony from any witness who actually saw a drug delivery involving this defendant?
Not as far as that July 2nd possession is concerned, no, Your Honor.
And the whole possession case is that July 2nd conversation?
That's the possession case, yes, Judge.
And so it is dependent upon inferences from what he said about the drugs being fat?
Yes, and it's our position that the inference that the jury drew were reasonable in light of the conversation that they had that day where Johnson called up Benson and said the drugs were fat, not like the stuff that he used to send Pumpkin through with. So clearly, Johnson saw the drugs that were delivered to him and arguably the unknown male as well, his girl's little brother.
Well, do you think the five gram sentence survives if the conspiracy count folds?
If the conspiracy
still have the possession?
Absolutely. If the conspiracy count were to be vacated, then the possession count would still stand because we've got the telephone calls between.
Well, Mr. Potts says there's no jury finding that Johnson possessed with intent to distribute the 5 grams or whatever it was, but it's just that the conspiracy handled that much.
Well, I think, Judge, if this court were to vacate the conspiracy count, then what the government would rely on for, as far as the sentence is concerned that Judge Manning gave was that not just with this one deal, but with the rest of the deals would be considered relevant conduct. That would add up to the 31.5 grams of crack cocaine that Judge Manning found at the sentencing hearing.
So Johnson handled 31 grams?
Yes. That's what Judge Manning found at the sentencing hearing. The calls that we attached to to our brief in the appendix show those calls that added up to the 31.5 grams of crack cocaine. So,
but is there a jury finding that he possessed with intent to distribute 31 grams?
No. No, there's not.
Isn't that a problem, though?
I don't believe so, Judge. If this court were to vacate the conspiracy count, even if it were to send it back for resentencing, the question then is, putting aside the question of sending it back for resentencing, even looking at the record as it stands now, Judge Manning found that there were 31.5 grams.
But doesn't the jury have to find that there are more than five?
To impose a mandatory minimum sentence, yes. That's not true. There wouldn't be a minimum, because if it's just the possession count, there is no statutory minimum.
So even if it's just 1 gram, you're saying, but wouldn't the jury have to find at least some possession? I mean, obviously, have to find that he possessed at least a grain, right?
Sure, Judge.
But where is the jury finding that he possessed as opposed to the conspiracy?
Well, I believe it's count 12. They found.
So there is a finding of possession by the jury.
Yes, Judge. That was the verdict on count.
So you're saying the jury doesn't have to find a quantity unless the judge wanted to impose this minimum sentence. Is that what you're saying?
Actually, it's a little bit different than that, Judge.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't believe, and this is not in the briefs, obviously, but I don't believe that since this possession count doesn't charge, or it charges, does not charge an amount above 5 grams, that the statutory minimum wouldn't apply.
What's the maximum?
The maximum is 20 years.
In either case?
I'm sorry?
In either case, where the jury is asked to find a quantity not asked to find a quantity?
Either case. Because the indictment did not charge a minimum of 5 grams or a minimum of 50 grams, the statutory maximum is 20 years. There would be no statutory minimum.
Judge Manning wouldn't need to reconsider it in that event?
I think given her findings that there were 31.5 grams that were that Mr. Johnson was accountable for, that there is sufficient record to establish that there's a sufficient record to establish that that is the appropriate quantity for attribution to Mr. Johnson. Now, admittedly, Judge, we don't know whether Judge Manning would have imposed the same sentence absent a statutory minimum. We don't know the answer.
So there would have to be resentencing.
I think it would.
Before you sit down, I take it you're not relying on the trip to Iowa?
No.
So we don't have to clarify what that was all about?
No.
Good.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Getter. So, Mr. Potts, how much do you have a minute left? Do you have anything further?
Sure, I'd just like to touch on a couple things. First of all, as to sentencing, this court has expressly stated that any fact that increases the statutory maximum sentence must be proven to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's the Gilmer case. So, therefore, the only finding that the jury made as to the 5 grams was on the conspiracy count. So if this court vacates the conspiracy count, it also has to vacate that finding. Now, to argue that Johnson was culpable on the possession with intent to distribute claim for 31.5 grams is preposterous. A conspiracy, when you sentence someone based on conspiracy, you can include anything that encompasses that conspiracy. But with possession with intent to distribute, you have to focus only on what was proven with possession and intent to distribute. And the government has stated in its brief that the only set of facts that show possession with intent to distribute is that July 4th call where he bought 5 packs.
How much does the 5 packs amount to, Mr. Potts?
At most, 5 grams, at most.
Right. So on a resentencing, the district judge could consider that, right?
Right. But the district judge would not be bound by a 5-year minimum sentence, which is a significant
difference.
In addition, again, and we brought this up in our brief, the district judge is supposed to sentence based on reliable and not contradictory evidence. And if you look at the table laid out in the brief, to get to 31.5 grams, you had to assume that every single time Johnson called, even when Vincent said he didn't have any drugs, that Johnson got those drugs and resold them as part of the conspiracy. And, you know, the district judge was relying on Parker, who prior to sentencing, the judge had said may not be competent enough himself to be sentenced. So, I mean, there's just so many unreliable facts here
You would acknowledge that the judge could on remand look at the one call, whatever the date is, and come up with some amount.
I think, again, you're relying on Parker's testimony for the quantity, and Parker's completely unreliable. And if you look at the cost, which no one brought up at trial, how much do these drugs cost? It doesn't make any sense. They're selling a gram of crack cocaine for $30. When Parker testified that he bought $15,000 worth of crack cocaine for about $27 a gram. So he's making $3 a gram, and that just doesn't make any sense. I mean, the numbers just don't add up when you look at the record. It's the epitome of unreliable evidence.
Thank you, Mr. Potts. Your time is expired. And thank you, Mr. Getter. Mr. Potts, so you were appointed,
yes.
And we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client.